Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Republic Forces Radio Network. I'm Jerry, and we're here today to discuss Front Runners, Season 5, Episode 3. And I am joined once again from our crew from last week. We've got Nathan.
Hey, guys. Nate here, celebrating the 15th anniversary of the Star Wars Timeline Gold with a new web series from the Star Wars Library. Check it out at youtube.com/chronoradio, the old school name. Glad to be back.
All right, we've got Barrett.
Hey, everybody, it's Barrett, Master Collect Them All from the forums, your Swan Holocron Enhancer. And I just want to say, Nathan, well, happy birthday. Happy birthday to the to your creation there.
Thank you.
And I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to talk about this very interesting episode of The Clone Wars.
All right, and also we have Jonathan.
Hey, everyone. Thrilled to be here. And Barrett, I agree with you. I think this episode has some interesting points, and I can't wait to discuss it.
All right. Now we are continuing from the episode that started us last week on this arc. And this is our second episode in this arc. Guys, let's go around that same order. And let's just say a little bit about what you thought about this week's episode.
Well, for my part, I thought it was a pretty good episode. It had a few points that were a little bit jarring. It was more just a matter of lines, not necessarily feeling natural. If we are to take down this station, or get out of the seat, or get out of the cockpit. Hot shot. As soon as hot shot hits, it threw me off. But aside from a few little rough spots there, I think overall it was a pretty good episode, though it probably should have aired alongside the next one. The ending just felt like a weird stopping point to me. So there were some jarring moments, but from a quality standpoint, overall, great episode, and it's going to be awesome when we've got it on Blu-ray with the ones on either side of it.
Yeah, Nathan, the ending was supposed to be kind of like a cliffhanger, but I think we all called it, and I think most of the viewers out there called it, that they were brother and sister. It was supposed to be like a, to Ahsoka at least, a dun-dun-dun kind of moment, but yeah, I think we all figured that out. So yeah, the ending was kind of weird, but the rest of the episode, I think that if you found the protagonist more as rebels, I think you would like this episode a little bit better than if you found him as terrorists. And I think we'll get into that. But I thought this was a really, really good episode that you can tell that the storytelling is a little bit more concise, but they told a whole story within the episode as well as kind of, you know, leaving it open for more. So, you know, Filoni had talked about bringing on different writers from television, from different dramas to come in here and write the stories for season five. And I think it really shows. So it's a very good episode. I really liked it.
You know, I agree with what you guys have said so far. I think this is a good episode. I think there was a lot of good action, but I'm seeing this as a really, I think, evidence of what Filoni was talking about at Celebration, of how these four episode arcs are getting to be fit together a lot, maybe a lot tighter than we've seen before. And I am interested to see this as sort of an entire arc. I think that the flow will be really, really good. This episode moved the story along, and I think it's setting us up for some pretty amazing stuff on the back end here.
Yeah, you know, guys, I thought this was a fairly solid episode. It gave us some good action and certainly progressed the story. But again, just like last week's episode, it left me wanting just a little bit more. I'm just like, okay, great. This is a good stopping point. I can't wait to see where it goes next week. But at the same time, you know, this could have been, you know, the final episode for Onderon, at least for a while. I think season two, this would have been it. We would have went on to something else, and then maybe we would have come back to these folks later. So, of course, we know we're going to get four episodes at this point. We already kind of have that information, that knowledge, so be it. But, yeah, Barrett, I'm with you, and I'm sure we'll get into this more into detail. I just thought that was a weird twist ending that really wasn't. It's like, wait a minute. Right.
Can I ask the question then?
Yeah, go for it.
I mean, should this have been something that we thought was a twist? Because on the StarWars.com episode guide. They spoiled it last week. They spoiled it with all their descriptions last week. But in the episode, they didn't. And this episode has one of those moments that had me go, whoa, ew, for a second. Because right after they get in from their end celebration, I guess you guys saw the same thing, where Saw lifts up Steela and they're spinning around and she's coming back down and it looks like they're about to kiss.
Totally.
Except they don't. And I remember thinking, ew, for just a second, but then it struck me, had we been told that they were brother and sister outside of the website, and sure enough, a matter of minutes later, we get that supposed twist at the end. Did they spoil their own episode, or was this something we were supposed to have known, just the characters weren't supposed to? Because I can't tell what they were intending.
Well, remember last week, I think it was me who made the statement, where in the episode is it that we're told their last name? How do we actually know? I wouldn't have known if it wasn't for Wikipedia. That's the only way I know they have the same last name. Now, what went through my head was, holy cow, they're not brother and sister, they're husband and wife. Although, that would have been some really serious awkward moments for Steela in the first episode, because she's clearly flirting with the dude. But wouldn't that have been funny if they're like married? But obviously that would have been way stupid. But I don't think the episode ever told us anything about that. I think they kind of did spoil it. For me, the question is, who cares? Why is she like, oh no, you don't understand, it's important
what
that
difference
I go,
does it
yeah,
make?
I have well, to go see him because he's my brother. So?
I don't think that the majority of the people watching this episode would necessarily be the sort to go to the to StarWars.com or to Wikipedia to look at this stuff. I think this is really just us. But I don't really know that it made that big a deal. I don't think they set that up as well as maybe they could have, where, you know, the fact that they were brother and sister made more of an impact. I think, Nathan, you know, kind of what you said with the first episode of this season when Adigalia died, you know, okay, so what?
Well, on the same token here, I think aside from the fact that we don't have a twist that really feels like a twist because we knew that, I mean, Barrett said it well there. Who cares? Jerry said the same thing. Who cares? Because the ending is, I guess, you're the leader now, Steela, and then he walks off. It's like, let him go. He needs to blow off steam. Okay, time out. Blow off steam from what? Because he sure didn't appear to be all that upset or mad at the fact that she became the leader. It's like there's all these things we're supposed to be feeling or thinking about the end of the episode that we weren't. They didn't give us the cues necessary leading up to it for us to be in the mental place it seems like they expected us to be, which is unfortunate because the rest of the episode does a really good job of setting up a lot of moral quandaries, and yet once that all plays out, we don't wind up where they want us to be.
Well, I guess that might just be one of those things we'll just have to find out and see why it's a big deal, because apparently, I'm guessing at some point, we'll see some interaction, or at least the result of Steela and Saw talking, and maybe we just find out she's the younger sister, and it's just very embarrassing for Onderonian men to be shown up by a woman who's more skilled in bat. I don't know. I mean, who knows how this will play out, but I guess for now we'll just kind of have to wait and see. So
I don't know, more skilled than a guy that can slide down a rooftop, somehow jump down without the force between two buildings and rip the head off a battle droid barehanded? I don't know. And somehow get back up to the rooftop again very quickly?
Yeah, I had to just write down the note that, hey, you could walk up to an armed battle droid, announce you're there, have the droid point his gun at you, and you just tear his head off like he's made of tinfoil.
After Ninja Gaidening down the buildings. Don't forget the Ninja Gaiden moment.
Wait, you know, it's obvious that Onderon is a high gravity planet, and, you know, its natives are very strong. That's
obviously their natives are acrobats, because they're all doing certain acrobatic spots to get that little ball that they've all used. That, you know, this ball that they use to deactivate the droids. You would think that the Republic would make a big ball that they could shoot at droids that are marching at them on fields, you know, because they have these little balls. That's like the all kill all droid ball ever. If you have one of those balls, man, you could take out a destroyer. You could take out a battle droid, a super battle droid. You could take out tanks with these balls.
If they had a really, really big one, they could just dump it in that recharge center.
Phase four of the Clone War, of the clone armor, should be made of these balls.
You know, what they're telling us here is, you know, these are supposed to be essentially ion grenades that the Republic has had. These aren't supposed to be things that they've created. They had those one things they created at the end of last episode, but these are supposed to be Republic issue munitions. And yet even the StarWars.com episode guide seems to be confused as to whose these are, because they call it on StarWars.com and not an IED, an improvised explosive device, but an IEMD, an improvised electromagnetic device. Okay, pick one. Is this something the Republic has provided? Is it not? Because it sure looks like those same ones they were practicing with last episode that the Republic provided, the ones that we get in, among other things, say the Republic Commando video game. There's all these weird inconsistencies.
Nathan, I'm going to kind of pull in some EU stuff here. In the book, I believe it was Labyrinth of Evil, the one that took place right before Revenge of the Sith. Obi-Wan and Anakin are on Cato Nemoidia, and they're assaulting some sort of bunker from the Nemoidians. And at one point, they decide they're going to call in, you know, some sort of droid strike or EMP strike. And all the clones have to take off their armor and shut it down so that they can sort of electronically wipe the area. I'm wondering if this is kind of something they're developing too with this, or if it's just happenstance. But I found that very interesting, that the, like you guys, the frequency of using that, and there have to be some disadvantages. And I think, you know, when you think about, you know, the clone armor is still uses a lot of electronics, and the clone equipment is a lot of electronics. There would be a disadvantage there as well.
Well, it's true. We only really see, what is it, the night vision goggles, really, for these guys, and Steela's sniper rifle. But for the most part, we don't really have a lot of electronics on the gear for these guys, at least not that was noticeable.
You know why? Because these guys are terrorists, and they're using weapons as terrorists. And these little balls are, what is that, Nathan? They're not called IEDs. They're called IEADs.
IEMDs.
IEMDs and IEDs. I mean, that's what every American knows what IED is. Every American knows what a car bomb looks like when they set one off in the middle of a square. And I say that these are terrorists because they call themselves rebels, but the rebels that we know are, they call themselves rebels, but they had their kind of their own army. They engaged in space battles. You know, so it was more of like the rebels we knew were kind of their own country, and they just kind of called themselves rebels, but they had built themselves up to a force to be reckoned with, that they could go after a space station and Palpatine and Vader in force, in mass. These guys are not rebels that we would generally think of rebels. I think they're generally look like terrorists. And a couple of times in this show, when they did things like the car bomb and a few other things, it was kind of hard to watch, because are the droid army a meta, you know, is that supposed to be the United States army and the terrorists? It was just hard to watch at some points. Did anybody else get that?
Well, you know, Baron, I think that's a good discussion point. And we actually received a voicemail this week that got us right into that same topic, particularly as it talks about, hey, what is this Rebel Alliance, and are they really a Rebel Alliance, et cetera, et cetera. But let's go to that voicemail right now with Glenn.
Hey, this is Glenn calling in about the Clone Wars episode that aired today, the second chronologically this season, third aired, Front Runners. And my feeling on this, I enjoyed this episode. I thought it was a really solid episode, but it's not like, you know, one of my favorites, and it wasn't, you know, one of those horrible things that you wish they never made. I think it's going to sort of really, in the long run, sort of just be a good part of this arc. I mean, the one thing that I kind of sort of liked, but not really that it was actually a good thing, is it seems that they're sort of addressing the Ahsoka Lux thing, and that it's not going to work out well for Ahsoka. It is what it seems like, and I hope it goes that way, because a lot of people seem to have this weird idea that Ahsoka and Lux are going to run off together, and that's how she's not going to, like, die. But that really wouldn't solve the problem, because, you know, after Episode 3, there is no Jedi Order, and she's still a Jedi. So, I mean, she still would be someone that they would be going after they're trying to kill, regardless of whether or not she's, you know, part of some collective group. I mean, she doesn't lose her power. It's not like she can become unforce-sensitive. And that's what the danger is. So it looks like that's definitely going the wrong way, because what looks like a double love triangle, or, I don't know, four people, you know, whatever it was going on there, with Saw and Steela being brother and sister. So obviously, Steela's, you know, doesn't have anybody else that's vying for attention. It's just Lux going between Ahsoka and Steela, and Steela is definitely a much better match for him. you know, Ahsoka just has, you know, like the first boy that she ever met outside the Jedi Order that's like, you know, contemporary, and yeah, he thinks he's kind of cute. She's like, oh, wow. But it's like, you know, there's a whole big world out there. There are lots of other guys out there. I mean, there's nothing real, you know, on their relationship. There's, you know, they don't really connect. They disagree about just about everything. So, I mean, I'm glad that that's not working out, and it's going to hopefully put that sort of, you know, I don't know what you call that, a rumor or whatever, to rest, that they're going to run off together. Well, the only thing that was kind of odd, although sort of kind of a good sort of animation thing, is that they saw the Jedi in their robes, and they look really good in their Jedi robes. But at the end of last week, they talked about, you know, you need to, you know, go to the city and try to fit in, and, you know, so, you know, just, you know, blend in with the population. And here they all are, with the Jedi wearing their Jedi robes, and obviously Ahsoka's got Togruta, so she's got to hide her, you know, her headtails and everything up. But then the rebels are still dressed in sort of their very militaristic outfit. It's like a group of 501st people going, trying to fit in, and but walking in someplace in their armor still. It's like, dude, you need to take off your armor and put on normal clothes so you fit in with everybody else. I mean, they're not fitting in at all, and obviously that's an issue with, you know, the animation and remaking models for these people, but kind of didn't really make sense. I really liked how they figured out a military target, and it's kind of the one thing I want to say in terms of the question I'm sure may have come up is the rebels versus terrorists, and to me is that rebels hit military targets only, and terrorists hit any target and kill civilians. So far, the rebels here have only been hitting, you know, battles. They haven't killed anybody. They've only been taking out droids. So, happy with that. It's kind of unclear exactly how, you know, it's going to go, but hopefully it'll go well. And I really don't see how this, quote, rebellion would lead to the, you know, rebelling against separatist hold on your planet, how that leads to sort of, it's not like they're trying to rebel against the separatists at all. But, you know, they're not necessarily opposed to be the separatist government, they're just opposed to their planet being under separatist rule. So I don't sort of see how this is like the birth of the rebellion that some people seem to be thinking it is. But maybe the rules could be wrong somehow. And look forward to hearing what you guys thought. Bye.
You know, it's interesting to bring up this idea of, you know, are they really the Rebel Alliance? Because people have been making those types of comments, but it's not just fans that have been making the comments. I don't think fans would have necessarily put those together had it not been for Filoni and Lucas coming out and saying that this is the season we'll see the buildup of the Rebel Alliance. Filoni himself has repeatedly said that this is where this is coming from. In the featurette this week, for instance, he sort of lays out this idea. Previously, they laid out the idea that, you know, the terrorist-style tactics, the hit-and-fade kind of tactics that Anakin is teaching to these people on Onderon is going to be the type of tactics later used by the Rebel Alliance. He even more explicitly talks about it this week, though, the idea that what they're doing, essentially, if this works, is on planet after planet after planet, essentially creating rebel cells who are designed to bring down whatever the government is on that particular planet and be able to still survive afterwards. And right now, at least, they're on the side that Anakin supports. But essentially later, what you're going to get is leading up to the Corellian Treaty, for instance, to use the EU reference and the Force Unleashed reference here, what you essentially wind up with is planet after planet after planet has these rebel cells on them, but you'll need, as Filoni noted this week, someone like a Bail Organa or a Mon Mothma who'll be able to bring them together. And of course, from Lucas's approved storyline for the Force Unleashed, we've got Starkiller being the one to also pull it together. But I mean, they're laying out all the little bits and pieces here to say this is why the Rebel Alliance can be as strong as it is, because all these little cells on different planets already existed. They just weren't organized. I mean, heck, the Onderonian fighters in this episode have a partial Rebel symbol on their helmets, which, of course, we know later Lucas gave the thumbs up for it being the Starkiller, the Merrick family symbol. But we get at least a piece of it here as a reference, and the armor here as a reference to Return of the Jedi. So, I mean, it may seem like a bit of a stretch. I think it's a bit of a stretch. But to Filoni, to Lucas, apparently not.
I like the concept of, hey, this mentality exists within smaller groups, and right now they're not big enough to be their own rebellion in of itself against anything. They're just focused on their one relatively little planet. And in fact, what I thought was interesting was how when they started these strikes, that they were lacking what they called the confidence from the people. Like, they were scared. And, you know, if you actually watch it in the show, these three people, you know, jump out with guns and just start shooting in the open area, and people are freaked out. It's like, hey, yeah, they're shooting droids now, but I mean, who are these people? Will droids start firing back? Will they miss? Will they shoot? I can see all sorts of things that can start freaking people out. What'd you guys think about that whole concept of that? I thought it was actually really clever that they noted in the opening newsreel that, hey, even though there is a lack of civilian casualty, there's still fear. And I thought that was kind of important to point out. What do you guys think?
Well, I would agree. I think that it shows sort of like this inability to see the big picture. You know, they know that they want to, you know, get the droids out. They know that they want to, they cause a disruption. Now, as the episode kind of progresses, especially at the end, they realize that, okay, we not only need to defeat the droids, but we also need to get the populace on our side. It's a very fine line you have to walk between, you know, assaulting your enemies and swaying the populace, because I don't know. They don't make a point of it, but I don't know how much of the populace is really got a problem maybe with the new regime. I mean, are their lives changed that much? We never get a sense of that. That's something I guess I would have liked to have seen. The other thing is that when you look, they stuck out. I know this was discussed in one of our voicemails as well, but the rebels, let's just call them the rebels, are all dressed as, you know, they're wearing armor. They're armed, and all the rest of the populace is dressed in, you know, more robes and flowing clothes. They look intimidated. They look scary. And, you know, I would agree with you, Jerry, that if they don't know what's going on or why it's going on, it can be just as frightening to see, you know, a battle between the rebels and the droids as anything else.
And yet they don't seem to understand that. Like, the rebels themselves don't seem to get it. When it comes down to the end of the episode and they're discussing, you know, what they need to do now, you know, strike hard and fast more, do we need to get the populace's support and such, somebody does bring up the idea that they're afraid. The people in the streets seeing this happening, they are afraid, except for, you know, five people who show up and start randomly yelling, yeah, freedom to Onderon, woo-woo, whenever the tanks are destroyed and that sort of thing. Instead of saying, they're afraid because we're blowing stuff up and they don't know who we are, it's they're afraid that we won't be able to actually succeed, so they may not want to support us. They're not afraid you're not going to succeed. They're afraid that you're going to succeed and what you're going to do is going to cause more harm than good. They're afraid of what you are doing, not what you might or might not be able to do in the future. They're not getting why the people are afraid. And I hope that comes back in a future episode to be something for them to figure out, instead of being used here as a way to sort of push Steela into the leadership position. Because if that is the mindset to push her into leadership position, she shouldn't be there because she doesn't get it.
But besides the one Onderonian that is being kind of accosted by the battle droid, are any of these people seem oppressed to you?
I know, when I'm looking at them walk down the street, like when they have that scene where they're walking to go into the, I don't know if it's a bar or a lounge, but it's a dark place where they're all able to meet and talk with Obi-Wan. And it's the first time where the Jedi pull their hoods down and we see that it's, you know, Obi-Wan, Ahsoka, and Anakin. But in that scene, before they get into that place, you see the other people, Onderonians, walking around. And they're just kind of, you know, looking at the sun. If there was flowers around, they'd be smelling it. They really do not. There's no battle droids whipping them, carrying carts of spice or something down the road that you would think, you know, when you traditionally think of an oppressed society kind of being turned into slaves and workers and stuff like that. But no, you don't see any of that stuff. In fact, there's a surprisingly small amount of battle droids that are patrolling the streets, except where they're in a big patrol. You know, you would think that they would have a couple on every corner or something like that, but it's not really like that. So did we see any other oppression?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to me, it's, I'm not really sure that when the rebels made, or terrorists made the comment, oh, they're afraid you're not going to succeed, or they're afraid we're not going to succeed, I don't even know if that was supposed to be an accurate assessment. I mean, I think it has to be clearly that, hey, there's a lot of violence going around and heck, you know, what could happen? So I don't know if they're really calling it correctly, but either way, I think one of the things that starts getting us into Steela versus Saw, Saw versus Steela, is that Saw responds and he says, well, you know what? They're afraid and they don't think we can succeed. So let's blow up something big. Let's hit a big target. We got to do some major damage. And at first when I heard that, I'm like, oh yeah, that's going to help. Why don't you destroy half the city or something? That's going to make everybody feel better.
But, yeah, let's really scare the crap out of them.
Yeah, let's really mess something up. But apparently, I guess that is what we're supposed to take from it. Because Nathan, you said that there was just those four or five people that said, yeah, free Onderon, whatever. But then you see these snippets of like other people who aren't part of the rebel group who's setting a tank on fire. These people are doing this. You know, it's starting to build. So I guess we're supposed to be led to believe that it works. But what do you guys think? Let's go into the plot a little bit. So I guess at the end of the day, it was kind of Lux and Saw who really brought this together. But I guess it was Lux that had the idea that said, hey, I tell you what, if we want to do something big, and he probably has the right idea, let's do something that's only going to impact the droids and show everybody how capable we are. And they go after the power generator. What do you guys think about that whole plot?
Yeah, okay, let's take out the power generator so the droids won't be able to recharge and basically cut off all service to the entire city.
See, you know, that's what it sounded like at first. Let's take out the power grid. But are we led to believe that was a power grid to the entire city? I know it looked that way because everything blacked out, but it looked like it was something built specifically for droids. It didn't look like it was, you know, a natural part of the town. Like, hey, this is the town's power grid. Although granted, they black out everything. So I was really confused. It didn't make a lot of sense.
I took it as it wasn't part of the town because the aesthetic of the whole facility looked a lot different than what the town looked like. But I always just took it that once they blew that thing up, that it just kind of set off a chain reaction and blew a bunch of fuses. You know, if you blow up a power generator of that size, if it's hooked up to one power outlet in your house, you know, it's going to take out the whole city. It made sense to me that it would take out the whole city, but what a brilliant plan. I love the plan to take out the droids and wait them out. You know, that's the thing. It's not going to kill all the droids. We're not going to be able to destroy all these droids at once, but we just got to wait them out. Again, another reference to how they're terrorists, you know, because that was a big problem with leaving Iraq. You know, what they would say is they're just, if we announce the timeline, the terrorists, all they have to do is wait us out until we leave. And that's exactly what their plan was. Take out something big. The droids will have to recharge eventually. They don't recharge. We'll wait them out. I did like the fact that line that you said, Jerry, where they dropped it, that they're not powered by one central thing anymore. Cause you know, they learned their lesson episode one. So, and they're all individually powered, but by doing that, it makes the droids smarter, yet they're still lacking because they still have to have someone tell them what to do. Because after they destroy that power generator, they're still losing communication with each other. But what a brilliant plan. I loved it.
And then, of course, when the power goes out, they dress in black suits with night vision goggles and sneak up on the droids.
Who sometimes are able to see them and sometimes they're not. A nice inconsistency in the episode. But I would say that maybe this isn't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily push towards the idea that they're terrorists. What I'm seeing here, especially with the whole issue of, I think Jerry sort of introduced this idea into my head, talking about, you know, the sheer number of people who just don't seem like they care, who don't seem like they're particularly oppressed. It almost feels to me like this is American Revolution type stuff. This is the stereotypical way of looking at the American Revolution, though the specific percentages aren't exact. The idea that there's a third of the people who are for the redcoats, or who are for staying with Britain. So in this case, a third of the people for the idea of staying with the separatists, a third of the people who are against it and actively rebelling with hit and run tactics like we're seeing here, very much the American rebels and the Onderonian rebels. And then you get the third in the middle who really just don't care. They're going about their regular lives, and to them, redcoat, rebel, or in this case, you know, Republic, separatist, it doesn't really matter to them because to them, their daily life just kind of goes on anyway. Now, looking at the episode guide and going back to the episode itself, they talk about this is a power station that feeds into other substations around Issus, the capital city. So unless all those other substations are just created for the droids, and it would seem that the blackout negates that idea, this does seem like it is a public facility. You know, it'd be like, you know, blacking out New York to make a point about, you know, if there's some kind of operation need to be taking out in New York, or going into Baghdad and to go after terrorists striking in Baghdad, you shut down the entire power grid to Baghdad. Fortunately, in this case, what they're dealing with is droids. that their enemy is the establishment in this case. The enemy themselves are not terrorists. Can you imagine if these were human opponents shutting down the power grid, the kind of atrocities you would see happening from the evil enemy side against the human population if this had been human-on-human type stuff? I mean, you would think the darkness would lead to more problems, not less. Fortunately, oh goody, they're just droids. They don't act out when it's dark and they realize they won't get caught.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that makes sense. We clearly see that the entire city is blacked out, and I guess what happens when the sun rises, the battle droids are all wiped out. You know, we blew up some, the rest of them will just lose power, and then we can rebuild the charging station. We can get power back online some other way. We can do something. So maybe even though we took out the power grid, it's relatively speaking a temporary issue for us, but it's going to put the nail in the coffin for the droids. So interesting stuff. I guess it plays out. It works out. What'd you guys think about? To me, I thought the plan of, well, let's attack a small group and they'll send in some reinforcements. And when they do, we'll just take the tank, because they'll, of course, send a tank.
Okay, that's terrorism. That's the, what is it, green on blue type stuff that's going on. That's the terrorist tactic. Barrett, you win that one.
Again, a terrorist tactic. You know, use the enemies. We don't have the arms. We don't have the means. We don't have the artillery, the armor. So what we'll do is we'll take it from the enemy and use their armor. Let's use their AK-47s against them. Let's use their rocket-propelled grenades against them. And that's a terrorist attack, and that's a big win. But that is something that we see in Return of the Jedi, in the original trilogy, where, you know, we did get a hold of a, you know, one of those shuttles, Empire shuttles, you know. So we do take, that is a tactic of rebels and terrorists. But there's one thing, you know, the whole time I'm thinking they're having these different tactics that I'm like, oh, terrorists. The one thing that makes them not terrorists, that makes them rebels to me, would be the king, you know? And without that king being there and him being so evil and being so disrespectful to the other king, which we see is finally introduced, that we thought was silenced, but he's actually in prison, which is pretty evil in itself. If it wasn't for that king, now I'm starting to think of these guys as rebels.
Is he in prison or is he just under house arrest? That basically he's cut off from the rest of the world.
He refers to himself as basically, how could I start or stop these attacks from my cell? I mean, he uses some, I don't know if it's exactly cell, but he does mention that. And Barrett, I'm glad you brought that up, because I definitely want to talk about the king. You're right. This is the first time, because the last episode kind of put us in wonder as to the legitimate government, and did they choose the separatists, and are these people terrorists because they're going against the legitimate government? But this episode puts all that to rest of how we should feel about the situation.
Also, aside from introducing us finally to Sanjay Rash, right, the separatist-backed king, and Ramses Dindup, the guy who was the previous king, we also are now introducing, just like with Steela and Saw, two brand new voice actors into the Clone Wars. We got Kirk Thornton as Rash, and we've got Barry Denon as Dindup. So they really seem like they're loading us up on brand new voice actors this time. Why? I'm not sure, but kind of cool to see that they're actually doing it. And in that scene, they're giving us a lot more of those dynamic camera angles. Jerry, I know you love the scenic camera angles, but they sure do a whole lot of stuff that almost make you feel like you're on drugs while you're watching the conversation between the two kings, because every time they show Rash, the camera's doing some crazy tilted shifting thing this time. I'm not entirely sure why.
Every time they show the king, it's like they're looking from downwards, like you're looking at a kneeling position up at the king. And it's supposed to give a sense of power, but it's twisted because it's got a slight different angle. You're not just kind of looking from above, but you're looking from below to the side. And that was my favorite part of the scene. One of my favorite parts of the episode is when they introduce this king, because we just barely see him in the newsreel last episode. So we see what he looks like, but he never said anything, and we meet the new king. But when we're introduced to the usurper king, the king that's been put there by Dooku, what is he doing? He's eating fruit, right? And how disrespectful is it to, you know, that's one of the most disrespectful things, is to eat in front of someone to show kind of power without offering them some, you know, and actually do that in front of the old king. And the whole thing of him eating fruit and living lavish while, you know, well, we don't really see any of the Onderanians in ragged tattered clothes or anything like that. But, you know, just him with the opulence and not caring and kind of above everything and trying to intimidate the rightful king.
Well, and he kind of takes one that, I don't even remember if he bit into it, but like he takes one
yes, and wastes
half
it.
Whole and just tosses it in the fire.
Right, just like some pompous jerk king would do that. And I like the fact that the real king, who's in his jail cell, in his jail clothes, he's still more regal. He's still more presidential than the guy who's taking his blood and treasure and just wasting it. You know, he doesn't back down from this guy when he tells him, hey, you need to call off the attacks. He says, you know, the only way you need to call off the attacks, the only way you're going to do that is take the droids away from being there, the occupation. And I love that, that this is a real king.
And what does that say about the new king, to where obviously he really thinks this old king is in on it somehow? How is that even possible to the new king based on the way he's got him under some sort of incarceration?
Well, he's got that sense of entitlement, right? I mean, he's there and nothing is his fault, of course. I mean, when it gets down to it, you know, when the rebels are actually succeeding against the way that he's got the droids and everything set up, what does he do? He calls up Dooku and says, your droids are becoming ineffective against the rebels. Like, whose command are they under, sir?
Well, yeah, and Rash makes a statement, this loss will work for us. And I just like, really? Have you met Count Dooku? It's like, dude, you're going to call up Dooku, tell him that, hey, I lost. It's because your droids suck. And he's going to reach through the Force and snap your neck. It's like, who do you think you are?
Person who did that was a warden in the Citadel, and it didn't turn out so well.
Right.
Exactly.
Dooku does not have a good track record with people who fail him. Let's just put it that way. He is very harsh. You know, I don't know what took him so long to try to kill Ventress anyway. But everybody that fails him, whether it be droids or separatist leaders, Dooku has no love. You know, he really talks down to you. And I love that about Dooku. He does not accept failure. And he fails a lot himself when it comes to Sidious, is what's so funny. He fails a lot in his missions, but he doesn't accept failure from anybody else. So,
but this whole exchange kind of at the end leads us to something new. I guess they're calling it a super tactical droid, General Kalani, who Dooku introduces.
Yeah, I couldn't make out what he mumbled when he gave his name, but
yeah, it's General Kalani, and I'm interested to see if that is going to be somebody there to control the droids or somebody to sort of take over the planet.
We've seen this before, though, right? When we saw, when was it? It may have been with the slavers, the Zygarians. We've seen instances where there was a tactical droid there who was really the one calling the shots. And when the humanoid, you know, the sentient being who was there wasn't making decisions the way that Dooku wanted, the tactical droid, in a sense, was taking over. Or I guess another example of that would be the Ryloth trilogy.
Yeah, that
right?
was the Ryloth trilogy, yeah.
Yeah, with Wat Tambor and the tactical droid.
But there's something different about this one. He's already done up in the color. It seemed to me like he was done up in the colors for Ondran, you know, the same sort of that gold trim that some of the droids that were in the palace had. So I'm wondering if this is just part of Dooku's plan.
Well, we really don't know what the whole plan is of Onderon. Why is Onderon so important to Dooku that they're sending battalions of droids there to occupy this city? You know, what does Onderon have? You know, I know it shares Onderon shares a deep history in the EU when it comes to the video games. But, you know, I think we have a voicemail about that, don't we, Jerry?
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and take a listen to Ben Devis on the forums and his thoughts on that.
Hey, RFRN, it's Ben, or Devis on the forums, calling in about this morning's Clone Wars episode. I almost said last night's again. I really need to get in the habit of not saying that. But anyway, I've been a fan of the two Knights of the Old Republic computer games for a long time now. I mean, I must have played through each of them at least half a dozen different times. They're really fun. So for someone like me, you can imagine my level of excitement and interest when I first found out that Dave Filoni and company would be bringing Onderon in to the Star Wars universe, the Clone Wars universe, or should I say Clone Wars continuity. Anyway, being two episodes into this arc, or three into this overall season, I think it was Barrett that made the comment of this series being at a line or having it set the bar for what to expect, and that bar not like staying constant through these episodes. And after having seen this morning's episode and having rewatched it so I like can pick up on anything I might have missed, I can say for myself anyway that that bar is staying constant. I mean, the animation is, you know, still up there. I couldn't see how it wouldn't. The fights were good. They scaled back on the, I don't know, 90210 or teen soap opera, aspect of the first episode, which I was happy about. And they didn't toss in any, for the heck of it, OT lines. But that's just my personal preference. And, well, also, one other thing that I picked up, you know, from the second KOTOR game to these two episodes, it looks like, from what we've seen, that the architectural style from the game, or the second game, looks like they might have stuck with that a little bit. But I do wish that they would show us some more of the, you know, Onderonian Beast Rider side, because that, from what I've read, that has been a pretty big part of their history. And I know they can't do that very much with, you know, a four-episode arc having to focus on what we have seen already, but, you know, it would be a nice touch. But that about does it for me. I look forward to hearing you guys' thoughts on this episode, and as always, love the podcast. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, I think he's right. There's a lot of the design, maybe not as much from the video games, because the video games borrowed so much from the comics, at least to a degree. But yeah, you see some of this sort of traditional Onderonian architecture we see, but we don't see a lot with the Beast Riders. We see them a little bit in the previews, it looks like, and we see some cool beasts being introduced, like that weird bird whose name I forget with the finger kind of wings and such. But you don't seem to get a whole lot of other beast riding going on. What I want to see, if they really are tapping into the old games and the old comics as their inspiration, not just for using the world, but for story input inspiration, I would hope that the answer to Barent's question, it was Barent a second ago who said about what's the point of this planet, that it has a rich history. I would hope, I would pay money, I would clap and give a standing ovation to Filoni if they were to connect this back and say that there is something tying into the ancient Sith or the Freedan Nadd uprisings or something dark side on this planet that the Sith want. Something going all the way back to the stuff we saw in Tales of the Jedi. I would love that, but I don't think they're going to do it.
Well, it's certainly within Filoni, though. I mean, we know that Dave Filoni is very EU literate. I mean, he knows his EU. I'm sure he could pull that out of his fedora. Do you like that? He could pull it right out of his fedora and know exactly how to tie it together. Now, whether Lucas will let him or Lucas wants him to, that's a different thought, but that would be wicked cool. I mean, I don't know enough about the EU to have put that together, but Nathan, when you said it, I got a little excited. I'm like, man, that would be really slick.
And speaking of slick, one thing we really haven't dealt with this episode was the way they're still handling this whole issue of Ahsoka with Lux and the whole Lux and Steela thing. You know, she gets her, you brave senator, you handsome senator thing, where she goes over and hugs him. You've got Anakin reminding her, you know, giving her a chance to leave the planet whenever he leaves. And my favorite bit of possibly the entire episode, where Anakin turns to her whenever he's telling her, you know, she needs to retain her focus, and she says that it's difficult. He's like, I know. You know, I really understand. She's like, you do? I hope this opens the door for her to be the one person, perhaps, that knows about Anakin and Padme, because we know she's going to have to be gone from the series by episode 3 anyway. So chances are she wouldn't have got a chance to tell Obi-Wan or anybody about it. So why not give him one person who will know about it and could be a confidant to him in that regard, and then have that be something that is ripped away from him as yet another thing to send him on the dark path? What did you guys think about the way that they handled the ongoing quasi-love triangle, square, pentagon, whatever it is?
You know, my initial thought to that was, you just said that maybe Ahsoka can be the one person that knows. The way Ahsoka says, you do? I'm like, seriously, Ahsoka, you don't get that he's like hooked up with Padme? Because she kind of hung out with Padme a little bit, and it kind of seemed like, well, it doesn't seem like anyone's in the dark. They just don't want to admit it. It's kind of like the unwritten rule of, well, of course Anakin's emotionally involved with Padme. Doesn't everybody know that?
The Ortolan in the room?
Obviously, Ahsoka had to stay on the planet, you know, just for the whole Steela Lux triangle thing, but it was kind of an odd choice that they left her, don't you think? Given that she kind of sticks out like a sore thumb. I mean, she's the only non-human wandering around, and she doesn't even let's just step aside that the only people wearing cloaks are the off-worlders. And that obviously, you know, part of her headtails that are there, her horns are kind of going up and they stick out. But also during the battle, she busts out her lightsabers. How can the Separatists not pick up on that and not go, oh, wait a minute, the Republic is now involved here. We suddenly need to take this more seriously.
Yeah, she's not fighting in a cloak anymore. She is with her lightsabers out, and she's actually doing a little bit more than Anakin and Obi-Wan did, where she's battling the droids. It's not more of a, it was still more of a defense, but it was more out there. She wasn't hiding. But it makes sense that they had to leave Ahsoka there. I mean, Ahsoka is a commander. You have two generals, two high-ranking generals on the council who can't spend all their time training terrorists. You know, so they had to take a back.
It would have made more sense if they had left Rex.
Rex with Ahsoka, right. And if they would have left Rex with Ahsoka, it made more sense.
Mm-hmm. Or even just Rex in general. But yeah, I mean, I think, Jonathan, what you're getting at is in the first episode, the Jedi made such a big deal that the Republic can't be involved in this for some reason. And when you have one of your rebels or terrorists or whatever whipping out lightsabers, like, no, wait a minute. They should have been able to scan their faces and understand who they were anyway. When they were, when they're spying in on their training session, clearly it's like, oh, wait a minute. That's Obi-Wan. That's Anakin. That's Ahsoka. I guess it doesn't matter that they reveal themselves.
But you can't necessarily say, I mean, that's one of the whole points that Lucas makes, is that while the Jedi serve the Republic, they're not supposed to be essentially the military arm of the Republic. The Jedi Order is supposed to be sort of a third faction, so to speak, that is serving the Republic and being sort of sucked into this morass of everything. So for the Jedi to be there, I'm not sure that that is quite as much of a Republic presence as if they had left Rex. I mean, you would think that it would be, just from a visual standpoint, the impact it would have on the casual viewer. But the way that Lucas and Filoni talk about this, and the way that it's been purported even within the EU at Lucas's suggestion, we've got this sense of, yeah, but Jedi are a special case. Besides, you couldn't have left Rex around, because apparently, rather than getting back to the 501st, they needed him to get back to, as Anakin referred to them in this episode, the 501s. Apparently, he needed to get back to his collection of genes.
It's different having a Jedi present and observing, but she is actively working with the rebels slash terrorists, however we want to deal with them. She's not an observer. She's not an advisor. She's an active participant. That changes things.
And it doesn't seem to make any difference in Lux's eyes what she's doing, because, you know, to answer the second part of the question about their relationship, you know, I kind of get the feeling that Lux would be late if he was a judge at a bikini contest, because he's kind of not taking the hint from Steela or Ahsoka at this point. He's just kind of, you know, what's going on? She's not showing the passion, you know, that his mother showed, you know, the likability of how you could still, you know, his mother, we liked her, even though she was with the Separatist forces, she still had a personality that we liked. And it just seems like Lux is smart and he's brave, but he's not showing any of those qualities. Why even Ahsoka would still like him? You know, Ahsoka is a Jedi. She is a commander in the forces, in the Grand Army. You know, she should be attracted to someone kind of the same caliber. And it doesn't seem like Lux is filling that fit in that bill. And it doesn't seem like he's interested, frankly.
Here's the thing. Ahsoka should be off limits. Even Lux should just think, oh, she's a Jedi. Even though they've had their back and forth, I mean, on some level, he probably has to think of it that way. And quite frankly, I can kind of understand this. I mean, he's trying to liberate a planet. He's trying to establish, or reestablish, if you want to think about it that way, his legacy, his heritage, the government, whatever, whatever. I don't find it odd that he's not putting the romantic stuff two and two together. He's kind of got a lot on his mind.
Maybe his thing is that he's just a racist or a speciesist. He doesn't want to hook up with Steela because they're not the same race, and doesn't want to hook up with Ahsoka because they're not the same species. Maybe he's just like all the other Separatists, just a bastard.
But Jerry, I agree with you. I think Lux is very focused. He's sort of like, we saw that last year with the Mandalorians. He saw a goal and he went through it, and he missed all these other things. He didn't pay attention to the fact that the Mandalorians are probably not the group to ally himself with. Now he's focused on you know, the goal of, in his eyes, liberating the planet and getting rid of the king and removing the separatists. And he may not have sort of time or attention for anything else, or he could just be really dim.
He could also just be very chivalrous. I mean, if he is thinking the way that Jerry suggests, you know, Ahsoka is a Jedi, no matter how much I might like her, she's off limits. Then if he's a gentleman, he wouldn't be putting the moves on Steela or reacting to her, sort of putting the moves on him while Ahsoka's around. That would be a caddish thing to do. Maybe he's just a better man than that.
We could all learn a little something from Lux, I think. All right, guys, great discussion today. Can't wait for the third episode and see where all this goes. But hey, let's go back down with our original order here and share some final thoughts for this week's episode, and we'll wrap it up. Nathan, get us started.
You know, again, it's an episode that was pretty fun to watch. It had its jarring moments. I'm looking forward to seeing how this fits in with the grand scheme of things of not just the season, but specifically of this four-episode story arc. Again, I think this episode ended on a bizarre sort of abrupt note where I thought, hey, wait a second, the credits are rolling now? But once we are able to watch this heading into next episode, I have no doubt we're going to be seeing something that is on par with some of the better episodes of The Clone Wars so far.
Oh, Nathan, I totally agree. I totally agree with you that this is keeping pace, that this was a very good episode. The storytelling is leaps and bounds of what sometimes of what we get, because this could have went boring real fast, you know, and it didn't. It kept me engaged. The new characters that were introduced, I liked them. I wanted to know more about them. Even that kind of screwy end of the episode where the whole revelation is that Steela and Saw are brother and sister. You know, we talked about that like it was the Cuban Missile Crisis. So they must be doing something right over there, you know, with the storytelling. If we, you know, if not just us, but other viewers in there, I'm sure got involved with the story, got involved with these characters. So with that, you know, I'm going to predict that not all these characters are going to be around, that we're going to have to see a couple of them die, because with this liberation, you're going to have sacrifice. And I don't think it's going to be Lux, because his mom already bit it. And he's got to, like you said, Jerry, keep that legacy going. So it's either going to be Steela or Saw. And I don't know, you guys. I'm predicting that it's probably going to be Steela that's going to get it. And maybe Lux and Saw are going to have to figure out how to be co-kings or whatever they're going to do. But I like this episode. I can't wait till next week.
You know, I can't agree with you both more. I think this is, again, building that nice momentum that's going to push us into these last two episodes. And I'm predicting that the final episode of this arc is just going to be amazing and probably one of the best things that we've seen. As I've said before, I'm continued to be impressed with the production value of these episodes. I think some of the shots that they did sort of sweeping through the whole city were just amazingly impressive, as well as some of the detail work. I didn't say anything about it last episode, but the movement of the cloaks and such in the animation, it's just phenomenal. It really, the other day I was watching some of the first season on the Blu-ray with my boys, and it's a different animal entirely. It's amazing how far that they've come with this.
Yeah, Jonathan, I have to agree with you on that. I mean, Nathan alluded to this earlier. I really like the big sweeping overhead shots of the city that made everything seem huge and just made me feel like I was on a new planet, not just like a little city of a planet I already knew. So I really like that. I also enjoyed this episode seeing some of those little commando ninja droids again. That was kind of cool seeing them flip around and jump around. We hadn't seen that in a while, so cool to kind of see how that was a little bit of a threat, that these rebels weren't trained for them, but they pulled it out. And really, Lux and Steela and Saw, you know, they take turns saving each other's lives. I mean, there's not a one among them that's just like the all-time, all-around, always the one who's going to save everybody else. They all have a time to be heroic here. Now, I'm going to go back to Ben, your voicemail. You had mentioned that there were no gratuitous OT lines. And for the most part, you're right. But I have to call this. The "he's my brother" line was so Princess Leia from Return of the Jedi. I mean, that was it wasn't just the words, but it's how she said it. You know, just the way Princess Leia said it to the Han Solo, you know, when he goes, okay, well, I won't get in the way. No, he's my brother. That's exactly how she says, he's my brother. We don't care as much. Again, we don't know why that is, but I've got to call that out as a little OT reference. I think there was something there, at least in how she said it. But guys, I agree with you. I think again, hats off to Filoni and the crew. In my head, we are 3 for 3 in this season. And, you know, Barrett, one of the things I think the show does, these shows have done a good job with, is that when you said Steeler or Saw, one of them's got to die, I'm like, oh, no, they can't kill Steeler or Saw. We're just getting to know them. It's like, hey, you know, in two episodes, that's how endearing I find these characters already. And good job. I think that's where Clone Wars has an opportunity, is to build new characters and kill them off. You know, so it doesn't ruin the movies. It doesn't ruin EU or continuity, but you create new characters and pick them off. And then you give me the suspense that I can't get with an Obi-Wan or an Anakin. So this show right now, season 5, is firing on all cylinders. So my hat's off. All right, guys, thanks for joining me this week. We will be back next week to discuss The Soft War. Bye, everybody.
Have a good night.
All right. See you guys next week.
Catch you later.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Berent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a Venganza Media production. Copyright 2012. All rights reserved.